Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
I'm going to give you a list of some very influential corporations. Google, Apple, Target, Ford Motor Company, General Mills, Monsanto. They do very different things to earn their profits, but they have one remarkable thing in common. They have all, at various times, encouraged their employees to meditate. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We typically think about the personal, individual benefits of mindfulness for physical and emotional health, but a growing number of companies are recognizing that physically and emotionally healthy employees can make measurable contributions to a creative, productive, and even socially responsible corporate culture. Reporter David Gallus covers business for the New York Times and has been tracking this trend for years. He writes about how it has evolved in his new book, Mindful Work, how meditation is changing business from the inside out. He's in town to speak tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
You call Steve Jobs America's first mainstream meditating CEO. What did his Zen Buddhist practice do for him?
Steve was the guy, in a way, who set the precedent for all of the CEOs who are now adopting mindfulness in their various ways. Now, what it did for him is, I think, still open to debate. Steve Jobs has been mythologized in a lot of different ways. Some of the lore plays up his famously irascible temperament. He was known to lash out at people who were underperforming in his eyes. And yet, there's another narrative of Steve Jobs that said he had a clarity, a vision, a way of seeing things clearly that allowed him to introduce some of these products at Apple that have allowed Apple to become, well, now the second most valuable company after Google overtook them earlier this year. But the company we all know and we iPhone and iPod owners love and adore their products. So it's no panacea. And you'll hear me say that a few times. Mindfulness isn't a cure-all. But it has a range of benefits. And Steve certainly talked about, for him, it helped him see clearly. It helped him tune out the noise, cut through the clutter, and get to the essence of what it is he was trying to design at Apple.
But was he actually doing this at work as part of his, you know, 8-hour day? Or I'm sure it was never an 8-hour day for Steve Jobs.
In the reporting of this book, I uncovered a story that I had never seen anywhere else. It was 1981, his first mainstream computer had just been a big hit, the Apple II, and this young fanboy, essentially, invited him to be the keynote speaker at a big conference in Boston. Much to this man, Jonathan Rottenberg's surprise, Steve Jobs accepted. And so all of a sudden, Steve Jobs, who even then, 1981, was a huge household name, had just been on the cover of Time magazine, was worth a fortune overnight, he's coming to keynote this first big gathering of Apple fanatics. Moments before Steve is about to go on stage, they're backstage, Jonathan starts looking for his keynote speaker, and he's gone. He's disappeared. He panics. He's scrambling everywhere, and then he spots him. Steve is facing the wall, cross-legged, meditating. Before the biggest moment, arguably, in his career at that point, addressing the fanboys, the people that were really going to be his product fanatics for the years to come, he paused to meditate. Now, this was 35 years ago, so there was no meditation program at Apple per se, but it was clearly an important part of his life even then.
One of the first companies that you found and reported on that actively encouraged meditation by its employees was General Mills. And sessions, let me make sure I have this right, at headquarters were led by, of all people, a high-ranking corporate lawyer.
So this is the story that actually got me on the journey to write this book. I had had a personal meditation practice for 15 years. It was something that I started doing in college. I spent the better part of a year in India, living in monasteries. But I always kept it a very separate part of my life. I came back to the United States. I became a business reporter. I would still go on silent meditation retreats from time to time, in between jobs, after graduate school. I would go and I would sit in silence. But it was not something I ever thought to bring to my workplace or incorporate into the way I went about doing my work. So a few years ago, I see just a brief Associated Press headline, very short wire story that said, in General Mills in Minnetonka, Minnesota, people are meditating on the job. And as a journalist, I said, well, that's a great story, irrespective of my own personal history. I got to go check this out. I get on a plane. I'm frankly very skeptical. who are these people? This is the company that makes Häagen-Dazs ice cream and Hamburger Helper. What do they know about mindfulness? Is it going to be anything I recognize? I mean, here I am. I still go on silent meditation retreats. What do they know about it? I get there. It's Tuesday afternoon. It's about 3 o'clock, just about this time. I walk into a big conference room off the main lobby, and there's about 36 people in silent meditation. And by all accounts, by all impressions, it certainly looks like they're doing the work that I learned how to do in India. But I still am kind of apprehensive. And then I listen to the woman who's leading this group speak. And she's, at the time, the deputy general counsel of General Mills. Very serious, high-ranking job. Fought battles with the SEC. Tried to push through the $10 billion takeover of Pillsbury. So this woman has been kind of in the trenches in corporate America. And she starts speaking. And she starts using phrases like moment-to-moment awareness. She starts using phrases like, wherever you are, just be here right now. Don't get lost in thoughts of the future. Don't get stuck dwelling in the past. And these are phrases that I had heard 15 years ago in India. And indeed, the lineage was unbroken. This woman, Janice Martorano, had studied with teachers who I had studied with in India. And so it occurred to me that this lineage was unbroken. Something had happened over thousands of years and thousands of miles to translate what I first encountered as relatively secular Southeast Asian Buddhist teachings to make it applicable, accessible in a mainstream way, in a totally secular fashion, to the point where it was being taught at General Mills of all places.
What I think is so remarkable about this, and what really caught my attention about the book and about talking to you, was the idea that this just flies in the face of what we think corporate America is about. You know, lots of people have worked in companies where FaceTime is really important, where no matter what, you don't want to be perceived as doing nothing. And I wouldn't say for a moment that practicing mindfulness meditation is doing nothing exactly, but it sure looks like nothing when, the people in the cube, two cubes down, or, cranking out spreadsheets and that sort of thing.
There's a counter narrative running through corporate America, and I think more and more companies are starting to wake up to this. And it goes something like this. It's important to work hard. It's important to meet quarterly expectations, and it's important to deliver great customer service and excellent products. But the only way that gets done is if our employees are healthy, if they're focused, if they're showing up on time, and if they're present and ready to do the work that takes their full attention. And mindfulness is one part, I believe, of this kind of broader suite of wellness practices. And it goes part and parcel with yoga on the job and better health and wellness services at any number of companies. I think mindfulness is probably at one end of the spectrum, whereas, free massages in the lunchroom for 10 minutes might be at the other end of the spectrum. But I think it's all part of this effort that a lot of companies are making to take better care of their employees. And that, to me, is a good thing.
What is happening in our brains when we meditate?
For many years, the conventional wisdom around the evolution of our brains, if you will, is that they were essentially static, that our brains matured, and that by the time we were adult, they were sort of fixed, and then perhaps, unfortunately, as we got older, they slowly deteriorated. In recent decades, we've learned that that's simply not the case. There's a term called neuroplasticity. That is, our brains are malleable, they're plastic. They respond to stimulus, whatever that stimulus is, and continue to evolve, to change as our lives go on, even very late into life. So rather than being fixed, rather than this notion that our behaviors, our habits, the way we react to certain phenomena are fixed and there's no way we can change that, we now know that that's simply not the case. The actual architecture of our brain starts to rewire itself as, for example, we play a violin. If we play a violin and we practice it and we master it, certain parts of our brain, our fine motor skills and the actual neural architecture that supports those functioning, they improve, they get stronger, they get more robust. We now have seen over decades of study that the same thing is happening with meditation, that as people meditate, sometimes for as little as a week, a few weeks at a time, the studies have shown, the brain starts to respond. And there are two areas in particular where I think the focus has been. The first is the amygdala. The amygdala is an almond-shaped region in the center of our brain. It's the center of our stress reaction. It's that little kind of jelly bean-shaped thing that sends on a fight or flight response when we get stressed. It releases stress hormones, it floods our body with tension, anger perhaps, and it often leads to us making very bad decisions. In the minds of meditators, people who have meditated even for just a few weeks at a time, the amygdala response is more subdued. So we start to see that the practice of mindfulness actually gives us more control over our stress response. It tries to lower that initial fight or flight reaction and give us a moment, perhaps, to pause and make a more considered reaction. The other area of the brain where the results are perhaps most pronounced is the prefrontal cortex. Now, evolutionarily, this is the part of our brain that's most evolved. It's the front of our brain, the center of our higher order thinking, our reason, our rationale, even our creativity. That's where a lot of these things that make us human are happening. What we see in the minds of meditators is that for those who have practiced diligently for several weeks at a time, and especially in the minds of people who have meditated for thousands of hours, is that the prefrontal cortex actually has more gray matter in it. That is, it's more robust. The muscles in our mind have gotten stronger. Just like going to the gym every day strengthens the muscles in our arms or our legs or wherever we're working out, meditating, mindfulness, it actually starts to strengthen the muscles in our brain. So those are just a couple of the initial findings. And I would hasten to add, the goal of meditation isn't to strengthen our prefrontal cortex. The goal of meditation isn't to have a less reactive amygdala. These are instead kind of enticing findings that seem to support some of the behavioral changes that we start to notice in meditators, which I think is where we should keep the focus.
What does all that have to do with our ability to say, focus on the project at hand rather than, you know, going to Twitter every 4 minutes when we've got work to be done?
Well, let's talk about what we mean when we talk about practicing mindfulness, because the word mindfulness and meditation can get thrown around a lot, but I think it's important to actually ground ourselves in understanding what it is we're talking about. Mindfulness is often defined as paying attention in the present moment on purpose in a particular way and non-judgmentally. And I know that's a mouthful, but essentially it means being right here, right now, focused on what we're doing in this moment at hand, rather than letting our mind wander, rather than wondering what it is I've got to do after whatever it is I'm doing, rather than thinking about the mistake maybe I just made earlier this morning or the way I said something to someone I care about that's bugging me. So often our minds are wandering and they're allowing us to be anywhere else but right here, right now. Mindfulness is the state of actually being present, of actually being right here, right now. But because our minds are so rambunctious, that's hard. It doesn't come easily. Instead, it takes training. So mindfulness meditation, which is what Google and General Mills and Aetna and so many others are actually promoting, is the process of learning how to be in the present moment. And it's actually something, as the results in the fMRI machines will show, that can happen. We can retrain our brains to do this. And here's how it works. Through mindfulness meditation, you simply pick often a sensation in the body. The most common one is perhaps the breath. And you notice the physical sensations of that, air passing in and out of your nostril, your lungs rising and falling, your diaphragm expanding and contracting. And you notice what it is to feel yourself breathe. Your mind's going to wander. Maybe it already has. When you notice your mind wandered, bring your attention back to that sensation. That's the whole game right there, and it's much harder than it sounds.
We're speaking this hour with David Gallis. He's a business reporter for the New York Times with a book called Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. He's in town to speak tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times business reporter David Gelis, author of Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. You can hear him speak tonight at the UTD Center for Brain Health series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. David, how does modern meditation compare with the ancient spiritual practice that it derives from?
In some ways, the actual practice of mindfulness that you might encounter at a company is, quite frankly, not so different than what you would experience if you went to one of the Buddhist retreat centers that I go to from time to time. That practice that I described right before the break, paying attention first to the sensations in your body and ultimately to your thoughts and emotions, noticing when you get distracted and bringing our attention back to the present moment, that is the practice. And that's what you'll find both in temples in India and now today at Google, Facebook, and more. So the actual practice is not so different. I think what's so different is the context. When I learned these practices in India, they were framed within the broader story of Southeast Asian Buddhism. Today, they are purely secular practices. They're being promoted as health benefits, as ways to strengthen our attention, completely divorced from any of the more secular contexts where I experience them, or rather religious experience. Situations where I first encountered them.
So there is a tradition in the United States, but it's sort of come and gone over time. How did the Transcendentalists discover meditation and how did they do it?
Well, when you look at the history of kind of Buddhist and, to use an outdated phrase, Oriental ideas in American mainstream culture, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, these thinkers who have become kind of bedrocks of our American culture were among the first to explore these ideas. This was, before there were Buddhist retreat centers or Buddhist professors at Amherst or Google and Facebook teaching these courses. And yet they got a hold of translated texts in the 19th century, and they started not looking at them purely academically, but actually wondering if there was practical wisdom in there. And so when you think about what Henry David Thoreau did when he went to Walden Pond, that many people describe as one of America's first experiments with mindfulness. He went there, he said, to live deliberately. And if you read the text, there are these wonderful passages where he actually is describing in vivid detail simply being in the present moment, noticing his body, noticing nature, divorced from this runaway train of thoughts that even then, in the 19th century, he was experiencing and he was looking for some antidote to. So this isn't a modern affliction where our minds are racing around so much. This is part of the human condition.
What did he say about his practice?
Well, again, I think it's important to describe. He didn't necessarily think of it as a quote-unquote mindfulness practice. We know he was reading these texts. We know they had kind of a practical interest in them, and in fact went so far as to try to translate them and publish them. This is Thoreau and some of the other Transcendentalists. But there isn't a lot of evidence to say that he was actually trying to teach himself mindfulness meditation. Instead, he speaks like this. He writes like this in Walden. "Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in reverie, amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiselessly through the house, until by the sun falling in my west window, or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time."
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with David in Weatherford. Another David here. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. I think you just covered what I was going to ask, and that was, what's the difference between transcendental meditation and your mindfulness meditation that you're speaking of?
Similar word, very different traditions of which we're speaking here. Thoreau, Emerson, they were known as the transcendentalists. These were early American thinkers and writers who were seeking to kind of go beyond the traditional Judeo-Christian framework in which they were brought up. Transcendental meditation is something quite different. Transcendental meditation derives from the Hindu religion, Hinduism, out of India, grew very popular during the 1960s and 70s. People like the Beatles practiced it. It's enjoying something of a renaissance these days, known as TM, popularized by David Lynch and other celebrities. And that is very different, actually, than mindfulness meditation. There are certainly some similarities in terms of the aims. Both seek to cultivate the attention. Both seek to kind of do away with the chattering of the mind. But the actual practice is quite different. In transcendental meditation, one recites a mantra, one that is given kind of a proprietary mantra that only you can know, and you recite that. Whereas in mindfulness meditation, what I mostly write about, the practice is, in fact, to notice in real time how you are feeling, your thoughts, your emotions, sensations, in ideally a non-judgmental way. So not reacting, just trying to experience whatever's happening in a gentle, accepting fashion.
All right, let's jump back to 21st century corporate America. It would seem that executives or people who wear a suit to work every day and sit in a cozy office maybe have time to carve out for this sort of thing. But there are companies that have made mindfulness practice available to employees at all levels and in all positions.
One of the most remarkable examples comes up in northern Vermont. And one snowy day, I kind of drove almost to the Canadian border and showed up at the offices of Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, you know, those K-cups that you find in maybe even this office right here. And I had heard that they were practicing meditation on the job. And indeed, the CEO of the company, a guy who kind of took the company and made it from kind of a small coffee roaster to the big multi-billion dollar company we know today. He had been a meditator for a long time. And when I tell you his previous role, perhaps you won't be surprised why. Previous to running Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, he founded Easy Wider Rolling Paper Company. So this was kind of something he was interested in. Nonetheless, he gets to Green Mountain. He's a meditator himself. And then he does what so many CEOs who are interested in this do. They say, this has been beneficial to me. It's supported me in my attention, my ability to interact with colleagues. Let's roll it out to kind of the C-suite, to other executives. They did that. There was benefits. People were less stressed, more attentive, better engagement on the job. Then they rolled it out to the next level of employees, kind of the, you know, everyday office workers, graphic designers, people doing production and sourcing. And there, too, there was great receptivity towards it. But then these guys went one step further, and I think this is amazing. They said, if this is an antidote to stress, if mindfulness can help reduce stress levels, and we should talk about that, that's one of the things mindfulness is best at and best known for these days as a way to reduce stress levels. If mindfulness can reduce stress levels, let's bring it to our workers who perhaps are most stressed. The people on the factory floor, roasting coffee beans, packing boxes, driving our trucks. They were smart, though. They didn't think that everyone was going to fold their legs and close their eyes. They recognized that for this group of employees, they might need a different kind of program. So they worked with a yoga teacher to design a purely secular, mindful stretching routine that they rolled out. And then within several months, every one of Green Mountain Coffee's facilities was doing this. So the people that previously showed up to work, threw on their clothes, and got straight into it, were instead taking 10 minutes to do a series of mindful stretching exercises to calm down, to regulate their heart levels, to limber up their limbs, get ready for some, you know, rather intense physical labor for some of them. And what did Green Mountain see? In the first full year after this, accidents and injuries on the job had actually decreased.
Some companies that have put these practices in place have found that they also cultivate a more compassionate spirit among the employees. How do shareholders feel about investing their money in a corporation that is compassionate?
So far, I have yet to see, and I do cover shareholder activism at the New York Times, but I have yet to see any institutional investors go after a company for frittering away money on this sort of thing. Perhaps that's because many of the bigger companies who are doing this are companies like Google that have cash to burn. That said, I think, again, to come back to an earlier point, in some corners of corporate America, including the investor community, I do believe there is a change in sentiment underway. I do believe that shareholders as well wouldn't think so poorly on a company making a proactive move to take better care of their employees in the same way that many big companies are making proactive moves to take better care of the environment. I believe it's all part and parcel of, at least in some companies and in some parts of some companies, I won't want to overstate this, but I do believe that there is a growing movement to take better care, more compassionate care of the people and perhaps even the planet.
Some companies have started this and then seen it sort of evaporate, and one example is Monsanto.
Of all the companies you would think would never get near meditation, just given on perhaps its undue and overly hyped reputation, Monsanto is probably near the top of the list. It is a villainized company, rightly or wrongly. And yet, in the mid-1990s, their CEO at the time was interested. He wasn't a longtime meditator himself, but he was interested enough to try it himself. He thought there was benefit. And so he worked with, I believe it was the Institute for Contemplative Studies. They brought in teachers. And there's a great scene that I uncovered in the book where they brought together a dozen or so Monsanto executives for perhaps an overly ambitious weekend-long silent meditation retreat. They were just throwing them in off the deep end. And everyone showed up in their suits and ties with their briefcases. And the meditation teacher, this woman named Mirabai Bush, who was there, and a longtime teacher who's kind of seen this whole thing unfold, she said, you're not going to need your briefcases and you can probably take off your ties. And yet she said, these people knew how to follow instructions. When she said meditate, they all meditated. Now, unfortunately, it didn't last, though it flourished at Monsanto for a few years, in fact. They continued to do meditation retreats. When that CEO was replaced, so too when all his pet projects, and Monsanto is the company we know it as today.
So many people who haven't tried meditation but are interested do it because they're experiencing stress. And you have multiple examples, including Janice Martorano was one. How does actively feeling stress interfere with our ability to do mindfulness properly?
I think actively experiencing stress interferes with a whole lot of things. Mm-hmm. I think stress interferes with our relationships at home. I think stress interferes with our ability to stay focused on the job and do our work well. And I think we know that stress interferes with our ability to have healthy lives and healthy bodies. So stress is a killer. The World Health Organization estimates that stress costs businesses something like $100 billion a year. I mean, the toll is substantial. That it isn't conducive to mindfulness, I think, is the least of it. What's so interesting is that mindfulness has been proven to be a very potent antidote to stress. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is a program. You can take it here in Dallas. I looked up. There are several places offering courses for MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, here in Dallas and in almost every major city in the U.S. and actually around the world. It's a purely secular, largely science-based, 8-week course that has become probably the most popular introduction to mindfulness over the last few decades. It was pioneered by a man named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was studying to be a molecular biologist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology when he developed MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. And MBSR courses are really the foundation for so much of the scientific and academic literature that you see in this field. And one of the reasons is because everyone who does MBSR does the same program. So it's essentially a controlled dosage of meditation that scientists and academics can work with and have, you know, somewhat replicable studies.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Adam on the line in Dallas. Hello, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
So I've been listening to this, and I'm thinking, actually, I'm a congregational rabbi at a synagogue in Dallas called Sheareth Israel. And I was wondering, to the extent at which you've encountered meditation or mindfulness in traditional religious circles, which I think always surprises people. Two examples from the Jewish tradition. The first is that the practice of the Sabbath of Shabbat is actually a disconnecting from the world, a la Walden, in which you sort of put down those things which you associate with the week in order to sort of bring yourself back to the center of who you are and the people around you. And then the other is that that there's a tradition in Judaism in the 18th and 19th century, this Hasidic movement, which is an offshoot of the current Hasidic movement, in which mindfulness is actually very, very important. And even in a religion like Judaism, where you're required to have sort of 10 people to pray, that certain rabbinic masters talk about the fact that you actually must do this thing called solitude, where you go out in nature and talk to yourself. And I think that people are often very sometimes surprised to hear that, even, I'm a big fan of the Buddhist thought, and also sort of, you mentioned Amherst before, and I'm a proud alum, but that people are often sort of very surprised to find that mainstream religion also does have this sort of strand within it.
Thanks so much for your call.
I write in the book that, in fact, every great religious tradition has meditative elements to it. There are, you mentioned the Hasidic Jews, Quakerism has a deep strand of what some people might consider meditation. There are Christian mystics who practice meditation. Of course, other Eastern religions that I mentioned, Hinduism for one, and the birth of TM, that's a form of meditation. So there are meditative traditions around the world, of course. Some of them, certainly to some, resemble mindfulness. And again, there are many paths to the same destination. And if that destination is being right here, right now, present and undisturbed by the wandering of our mind, I have no doubt that many of the different traditions, none of which I am expert in, I should say, will get you to a similar place. Mindfulness meditation, as it's being practiced and taught today, is so interesting because it is, in fact, a secular practice, which means that it is something that can be practiced in complement with these traditions. And in fact, in this book, I have Christians, Jews, Hindus, and Buddhists all practicing the same secular mindfulness meditation in complement with their own traditions.
We're speaking with New York Times business reporter David Gelis about his book, Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. He's in town to speak tonight to The Brain and Owner's Guide, the UTD Center for Brain Health series. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times journalist David Gelis about his book, Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. As this becomes a trend in business, David, are there concerns that the effects might be watered down, that it's just another obligation for employees to take part in, to prove their loyalty, to show that they're kind of doing what the boss is doing?
Worse, there is a line of thought that suggests it's, in fact, a sort of nefarious mind control that's...
Did you see evidence of this?
I didn't, but it didn't stop people from getting a bit excited about it. And there's even a term for it, McMindfulness. Right. So the thinking goes that, in fact, these are actually quite sacred traditions that are being co-opted, coerced, and reappropriated for the service of profit in ways that are entirely inappropriate. And that, in fact, when we talk about reducing stress on the job, the real way we should reduce stress is by making better workplace cultures and not expecting undue performance from people that compromises their health, rather than giving them what some people see as kind of medication via meditation.
Right.
So there is a strain of thinking that way. Again, you asked the right question. Did I see evidence of it? I really didn't. And in fact, when I talk to teachers who go to companies and teach mindfulness there, I ask them about this without fail every time. And one woman, Pam Weiss, she had the best answer I've ever heard. She said, this woman has taught Genentech, she's taught Salesforce, she's, you know, done these programs in lots of big companies. And I said, you know, how do you wrestle with this tension? And she said, David, I've never taught a company meditation. I've only taught people meditation who happen to work at companies. And I think that's the right way to think about it, understanding that this is something that is applicable to every single one of us, that every single one of us in our own ways is stressed. And if mindfulness can help make us a little less stressed, a little kinder to ourselves, maybe even a little kinder to others, where is the harm in that?
How do you define a mindful executive?
You know, I try not to, actually. The demands that an executive has placed on her or him are so myriad and so complicated, and it runs the gamut from investor relations to public relations to internal human relations. Now, someone who practices mindfulness may indeed be able to navigate some of those demands with more grace, with less strife. And yet, are they still going to have to make difficult decisions? Might they still have to fire people? Absolutely. And so it'd be just too easy to say, well, this person's mindfulness, they check the box, and so they can do no wrong. Mindfulness is no panacea. And even the best executives who practice this for a long time, they're going to have to make difficult decisions.
Are these programs always voluntary?
Yeah, I've never seen any mandatory programs. It doesn't mean they're not around the corner, but I have yet to see them. And we certainly don't have one at the New York Times.
David, do you have a mindfulness practice at the New York Times, something that the corporate executives have gotten behind?
So there has been interest, but we have not actually launched it. I've been part of some discussions in which we were looking for the right vendor, the right teacher to bring it in. But that's an important point to make. If you're a company and you want to bring this, say, all right, we're ready to go, where do you turn? There's actually very few options. This is despite the volume of companies and the big names behind some of these companies, it's still a very nascent field. And the number of vendors who have the capacity to deliver a kind of scaled mindfulness program for a Fortune 500 company, they're few and far between. So this is still early days for some of this. Now, I will say I did start a mindfulness speaker series at the New York Times. So to any of my colleagues listening, you know where to find it.
Tell me about this. There are people who might be interested in mindfulness, but the idea of sitting in silence, focusing their thoughts and their attention on the present sounds excruciating. It's interesting because, you know, it doesn't hurt. It's not like, you know, it's not even like getting into the gym after 6 months out. What is it that people find so intimidating about even attempting a practice like this?
It can be excruciating and it can hurt. There's no doubt about it. It's our impulse to distract ourselves, be it through social media or television or food or whatever our distraction or diversion of choice is, when we look at the reason we're doing that, it's often because we don't want to be alone with our thoughts. There's just no doubt about it. Again, that's part of human nature. That's not particular to this moment in time. That's not particular to the era of Facebook and Twitter. It's who we are. So, of course, any practice that asks us to actually just be present with the sensations in our body, our thoughts, our emotions, some stuff is going to come up. And in fact, when I go on meditation retreat, I have had some very uncomfortable experiences when I've had to essentially look my mind in the mirror and own up to what all was going on in my head. And yet, the payoff comes when we start to take more control of our thoughts, when we start to get to the point where, through practice, we can notice, I'm having a stress reaction, but that doesn't have to define who I am today. That doesn't have to affect all the other things that are happening in my life. I can recognize that, in fact, it's a fleeting sensation that I'm going to accept right now, move on with, And lo and behold, on the other side of it, there's just another present moment where I have the opportunity to connect with someone on a human level if I want to.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have William on the line, and I think it's Casagrande, Arizona. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
In the mid-90s, I worked for a company, Fleetwood Enterprises, and before production began every morning, the employees spent 10 minutes doing what your guest is describing. They would stretch and bend over and get ready emotionally for the day ahead.
And how was that for everybody?
I think it was positive. In, let's see, 05, I trained for and did a marathon, 26.2 miles. That's a long way. And one of the techniques we used to deal with the pain was we would put a portion of our consciousness somewhere else and not be in the present moment because it hurts so much.
That's really interesting. What do you know about that sort of idea, David?
The sports connection is actually growing. The Seahawks, in particular, have a mindfulness coach who works right alongside their weight coach. The Red Sox have brought in an in-house mindfulness guru. And all these people, I don't know if they're talking about compartmentalizing the pain, but they're talking about being in the present moment. And I have a section in the book where I talk to coaches and others who have practiced mindfulness in the athletic field. And they put it in beautifully precise terms. They say, if you are on the basketball court and you just missed a shot, is it going to help you by dwelling on the fact that you just missed that shot? Absolutely not. You need to be 100% focused in the next moment rather than allowing your mind to kind of get hung up on a mistake you just made. And that's what mindfulness trains us to do. It trains us to come back to the present moment over and over again, ready to be right here, right now, rather than worrying about whatever might have just happened.
What evidence did you see that there are potential benefits in the long term to corporate culture?
I was all ready to have an answer, and then you said corporate culture. And I think I want to be transparent here. I don't know that we have that evidence yet. I think there are benefits that, at least in the short term, because a lot of these programs are relatively new, that there are meaningful and measurable reductions in stress among employees, that communication and job satisfaction, job performance ratings seem to inch up a bit. Now, those are largely self-reported. There's also some data coming from companies like Aetna that show that, in fact, their employees are showing lower cortisol levels, less heart rate variability, which are common biometric indicators of stress. But when you talk about a long-term corporate culture, the answer is a bit more challenging. For that, I would point to companies like Patagonia, for example, the outdoor apparel company in Southern California. They don't necessarily have a mindfulness program. They're not teaching employees to meditate. And yet the founder and successive CEOs have all been practitioners themselves and have created a culture where people show up and they try to be present. Now, it doesn't happen through kind of routinized, taught meditation practice. Instead, it's something that's understood, that's part of what being at that culture is all about. I think we'll have to check back at Google in 5 and 10 years to see if their fast gains and at General Mills, if they actually have changed the corporate culture. It's maybe too early to tell just yet.
Not surprisingly, there are a wide selection of apps and technologies that purport to help you do this, especially if you're just getting started. What do you think of those?
The irony is rich, isn't it?
Yes.
Facebook, Twitter, apps, our iPhone are probably one of the greatest sources of our distraction. And here come the mindfulness apps promising that, no, in fact.
For $1.99.
And just a few more hours on your iPhone, I'll get you completely weaned off your iPhone. There are a bunch of very popular apps. Headspace is perhaps the most popular. Calm.com is another one. They're out there. And for some people, especially those who maybe are in rural areas where there isn't a mindfulness-based mindfulness based stress reduction course available, they can be enormously helpful. I, however, having learned from other human beings in person, really suggest that for anyone who's truly interested in mindfulness and has accessibility to a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, a mindfulness center, that they go in, because having conversations with other people about some of those difficult moments in mindfulness practice, it's quite valuable.
Is there any evidence that the benefit of mindfulness, which is staying in the present moment, at least temporarily sort of accepting the way things are rather than trying to immediately change things, does that affect ambition?
My friend Dan Harris, he's an anchor at ABC News, and he had a book came out about a year and a half ago called 10% Happier. And this is the tension at the core of his book. Dan Harris is an ambitious guy. I'm not going to offend him by saying that. He's been working his whole career to kind of get up and excel in the broadcast television world, which can be quite cutthroat. He eventually turned to mindfulness, and his biggest concern was that he was going to lose his edge. His biggest concern, and he writes about it powerfully in the book, he says, I was afraid that I was going to take my foot off the gas. Here I had to come all the way to being an anchor for nightly news on ABC. Was this going to make me weak? Were my colleagues going to perceive me as somehow being soft? Instead, what he found was that he still worked very hard, but he did so in a different way. He was just as committed to his work, but he was perhaps less frenetic about it. He was less attached, less clinging, less driven by that kind of ambition and fire that we know can actually be counterproductive when we let it get the better of us. And instead, committed to doing the work really, really well. Now, that's anecdotal, and I have yet to see kind of the peer-reviewed study that looks at mindfulness and ambition. I'm sure someone's working on it. But I think there is plenty of evidence to suggest that it doesn't have to take your ambition away. That said, in the book, I was interviewing lots and lots of executives, startup founders, anyone I could find who'd kind of practiced mindfulness and brought it, integrated into their work lives. And I have a whole list of people who started practicing meditation and quit their jobs.
How important is it that we approach mindfulness hoping for more than just to feel better ourselves, that we do this striving to be better people?
I think if anyone recognizes that they are stressed and they need help, and if they identify mindfulness as one way that they might find a bit of relief, then there's nothing to say that that isn't a noble and righteous goal on its own. Instead, I think what happens is through the practice of mindfulness, in a very curious way, as we develop more empathy and compassion for ourselves through the practice, we start to have more empathy and compassion for others. So I don't think it's important to go in there thinking that this is going to be my contribution to a better world. I think if some people come to it and say, I'm stressed and this is going to help me get less stressed, well, that's perfectly fine.
David Gallis is a reporter who covers business for the New York Times and author of the book Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. He's in town to speak tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. David, thank you so much for making time for
us. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.